Accession number 4423, reel number 1.
Colonel Lewis, reel 1. How did you come to join the army in the first place, Colonel Lewis?
During the war, 1418 war, I was then 18 and very keen on flying. And I applied for a commission in the Royal Naval Air Service and was accepted and began a career of flying, which took me to France in June 1917. And I was wounded and taken prisoner in later that year, in October. Subsequently, of course, the Royal Air Force was formed, April the 1st, 1918, and we all became members of this new force, the Royal Air Force. I came back to England at the end of the war from Silesia, from a prisoner of war camp in Silesia, via Danzig to London, and joined the Royal Military College, Sandhurst. I did my 2 years training there and was commissioned, with a regular commission, in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, which took me as a first posting to Southern Ireland, Limerick. And from there we came back through the Curragh and Dublin to Pembroke Dock. While there, I applied to take a long course with the Royal Air Force at Army Corporation at Uphaven, Netherhaven. And while on that course, I heard stories from a friend of mine about life in the King's African Rifles. I was told that there'd be little chance of my joining the King's African Rifles, as there was a long waiting list. It might take years. So I applied.
Had your friend been a member of the King's African Rifles himself?
Yes. He was Honey Wood of the 17th Lancers, and he had just come back from the King's African Rifles. And at the end of the course, which lasted about 6 months with the Army Corporation, I received a signal telling me that I'd been posted to the Somaliland Camel Corps, and I was to prepare myself to embark for Somaliland at very short notice. I was astonished when this document was handed to me. For one reason, I hardly knew where Somaliland was. But, of course, I could soon discover that, and I went through the normal embarkation formalities and found myself at Marseille, joining a P&O ship for Aden, and it was my first experience of the East. It was a great thrill and experience to see these places like the Suez Canal and Aden. And at Aden, I was taken from where I left the P&O ship and joined a very small steam boat belonging to Cowsley Jinshaw, the Indian firm that seemed to rule Aden. This ship was said to be unseaworthy about 1898, I was told. However, we sailed, and the captain celebrated sailing, a successful sailing, most of the journey over. He'd been dismissed from a reputable company, a British steamship company, and was eating out his last years with this coastal boat. And he deposited me on the shore, the sand dunes, near Berbera. From there, I could see very little indeed, except sand dunes. But after a short time, a posse of Camel Corps men appeared over the horizon, and came towards me, and they told me that they'd come to fetch me, and they were going to take me to the Berbera town. So off I went with this party to meet the quartermaster of the Camel Corps then, who was more or less permanently in Berbera. And he told me that I would have to go through Sheikh, which was up on the escarpment, very high, through to Berbera, to Barau, the headquarters of the Camel Corps. And from there, they were going to send me on to Hargeisa as quickly as possible, because C Company, which was the Pony Company, was going to march to go right up to the Black Issa country, that is in the northwest corner of British Somaliland, very close to the Abyssinian frontier, very wild, no roads, no hospitals, a district commissioner living up there in an isolated spot on top of a hill with the Union Jack flying, a real old outpost place. And we arrived there with the governor, who was going to read the Riot Act to the Black Issa tribe. And I had the commander of C Company, the Camel Corps, the Pony Company of the Camel Corps, was one Gladstone of the King's Dragoon Guards. And I was his subaltern. It was my first experience in Africa. As I rode along, I thought there must be a lion behind every bush. And when I went out in the evenings to view the countryside, I was sure there were lions watching me all over the place. But this romantic view of Somaliland, of course, became more reasonable as time went on. But I do remember the Black Issa, who refused to come in to see the governor, all arriving in a great swarm one day, and I could hear them singing. They were down in a very deep nullah coming along, and I was in that nullah. And suddenly, around the bend, the nullah being, of course, the dry, waterless
channel,
suddenly these large number of people rushed at me with their spears. They had 12-foot spears, 6-foot spears, very long spears, and they all went down on the ground and dipped their spears in front of me. And by then, this time, of course, the governor and the district commissioner could hear all this going on, and he knew that the Black Issa were coming in to talk.
Coming back to how you were posted, or got your posting to the Somaliland Camel Corps in Britain, do I understand then that you never even had to have an interview for the Somaliland Camel Corps posting?
I had an interview with a staff officer at the Colonial Office when I put in my application, but he was very pessimistic. He told me that it was very unlikely I would be required for some appreciable time, and I heard that it was fatal to say you wanted to join a particular unit, the 6th Battalion of the King's African Rifles or the Somaliland Camel Corps. That offended him very much, because you were being seconded to the Colonial Office, to the King's African Rifles, the Somaliland Camel Corps being part of that, affiliated to the King's African Rifles. So I kept very quiet as to where I wanted to go. I think perhaps if I'd had the choice, I would like to have gone to Kenya, because there was far more game and that sort of a very beautiful country. I was to live in Kenya many years afterwards, so I had a chance of seeing it.
So, was the interview which you had at the Colonial Office, would you say, rigorous, or was it a formality, or what?
It was fairly searching. They had my record, of course, from the War Office, and they knew, for instance, that I'd been a senior under officer at Sandhurst, And I just say that counted a bit. They also knew I was fit and very young. I think he overlooked the fact that I'd been a prisoner of war. But
had that affected your health?
Yes, when I first got home, it certainly had some effect on my well-being, health. I think everybody who came home from being a prisoner experienced some defect or other. But I think Sandhurst, doing 2 years there, made me absolutely fit again.
Did you have to make any special arrangements for going out to Somaliland in the way of kitting out?
Yes, there were one or two firms in London, Humphreys, in Haymarket, and another one in Warwick Street, near Regent Street. From that one, in near Regent Street, you got your camp equipment. You were given lists from the Colonial Office of recommended things, and of course one had to get the tropical uniform, the helmets worn in those days, and the outfit. And then one heard there was polo in Somaliland, so you wanted saddles and bridles. I didn't, as far as I remember, take a gun then. I certainly took a polo kit. I was looking forward to learn the game. And you had to equip yourself rather similar lines to going to the Indian Army.
Did you find that the equipment with which you bought in London was appropriate for Somaliland conditions? Or was some of it rather inappropriate?
I think it was quite appropriate on the whole. You wanted jode paws. I found them very useful for riding camels and then, of course, on horses, ponies. I think I ride reasonably well equipped. Yes, quite well equipped for the experience I was going to have.
And what about the advice which the Colonial Office gave to you before you went? Did they give you any advice about looking after your health or about how to treat the native population or any other kind of preparation, either verbally or in printed form, before you went? Or did they just throw you in at the deep end?
They gave a certain number of pamphlets. I remember one dealt linked with malaria. Well, Somaliland, there were not many mosquitoes in Somaliland. Malaria was not prevalent. I don't think any advice was given about how to deal with the Somalis, the indigenous people of the country, but I do remember asking the governor, Sir Gerald Summers, from the Indian Cavalry, who was then governor of Somaliland, whether he could give me any advice. And he said, well, I presume you were successful with your British troops, and if you treat these men like you treated your British troops, I think you will do quite well. Remember, they are equal to you and me. They are the African subjects of His Majesty the King.
And did you find them as easy to handle as British troops in actual practice?
There was yes, I think so. They were basically a democracy. The Somalis likes to express his views. He's a very happy person, laughs a lot, very fit, and well satisfied with the little he seem to have or acquire there. He required a diplomatic discipline. One certainly didn't drive them. They were Mohammedans, and they were fanatical Mohammedans. They were not versed with the depth of their religion. They were inclined to be extremists, and you had to be therefore careful with them in regard to their religious belief. There were no European women there when I joined. They weren't allowed because there were no hospitals. And the Somalis, of course, looked upon their own women in a very different way from the way we look upon our women folk in England and elsewhere in Europe. One had to be alive to this. I think one just had to be very observant and get to know them, get to know their language, which was really difficult, and go easily with them. They were very keen soldiers. They loved it. And they liked having rifles, of course.
Was there ever any trouble with any of the Somaliland Camel Corps units in the way of discipline or rebelliousness in the time you were with them?
I think the authorities, the military authorities, had come to feel they were rather unreliable. They were rather volatile. And that led to the arrival in Somaliland of a Yao company. A company was Somalis, B company were Yaos, C company, the horse company, were Somalis. The Yaos were brought up to provide a steadying influence. They'd come, of course, from Nyasaland, and they were quite splendid. But from their particular country, I believe they saw no animal much bigger than a rabbit. And therefore, when they were confronted by a camel, it was a great experience for them and a great shock. But they didn't mix much with the Somalis. The Somalis regarded them as pagans. They were not Mohammedans. And the Somalis had some sort of feeling that further down in East Africa, in Kenya and Nyasaland, that the Africans down there were pretty well slaves. The Somalis were a proud people, and they felt instinctively very superior to anything that came from East Africa, further down the coast. The Somalis were, in their opinion, were almost the supreme being of the East African coast.
And what did the Yaos think of the Somalis? Did you ever gather what they thought?
The Yaos seemed a phlegmatic people, very well disciplined, and I don't think they reflected very much as to who the Somalis were. They simply carried out their military duties and lived apart from them. They would exchange smiles and shout at each other occasionally. Of course, they didn't speak Somali. They were speaking Swahili and probably some other East African language. But the sergeant major of the Yao company, I can't recall his name, but he became RSM of the Nyasaland Battalion of the King's African Rifles and built up a great reputation. When he showed all signs of this, when he was the company sergeant major of the Yao company in Barao and on Trek. And I think, apart from the contribution by the officers who came up with the Yaos, this company sergeant major really, really pulled his weight, and he cultivated a good relationship between the Yaos and the Somalis, but it was always distant and cool. You wouldn't see them walking about together. Oh, no, dear, no. No, the Somalis were very proud, dressed up with his coloured clothing and so on, and the Yaos just looked at him and thought, well, something very different from me. How's that?
And do you think that the Yaos really did have a steadying influence on the Somaliland Camel Corps? Do you think that that policy actually, that the intention of that policy was actually fulfilled?
There was the tradition of the Mad Mullah there, and he was a fanatical Mohammedan leader, and it was a thought possible that the Somali tribes had not settled down from the effect that the Mad Mullah had on them, and that they might fall victim to something rather similar. And I think the Yao company would have been the sort of rear guard, supposing great trouble had come to the country and the Europeans had to evacuate back to the coast where they, from the coastal concentration town where they had come from, and the Yaos would have stayed with them and seen them through it. They would have been more reliable than the Somalis. The Somalis, there was a word, budmash. They were rather intrigued politically. That is what one was aware of with them, whereas the Yaos were waiting for orders, and of course they were tied to us too, because unless we were together, the Somalis would have an easy victory, supposing there was trouble.
Did you prefer one or the other, the Yaos or the Somalis, as an officer to work with? Or did you have no preference for the two different groups of troops?
Did not serve with B Company. It was a specialized company. Only people who had been with the Yaos down in Nyasaland served there, and one was apart from them. The company was there, one was very conscious of it, but one didn't get involved in their domestic affairs. I was with the Somalis, and I preferred taking an objective view of the two. I preferred the Somalis. They were more interesting. They were great characters, and they were intelligent, very intelligent people, and full of fun. Of course, they weren't always like that all the time. They could get very despondent, and that was one of the snags about them, that if things went very wrong, the Somali spirits would sink very low, whereas perhaps the Yao wouldn't worry so much. He would go through with his duty.
Did you ever have to punish any of your Somali troops?
Oh, yes, yes. But I was never, one never flogged a Somali troop. That would have been, there would have been great trouble at once if such a thing was even spoken of. Whereas the Yaos were flogged, I've heard. It was lashes, so many lashes. This was one of their regular punishments. But no Somali would submit to that kind of treatment at all. And in any case, I was very much against it, and I think most officers were. But it was a means of, an ultimate means of dealing with the Yaos.
So what punishments could you have recourse to with the Somalis if you couldn't flog them?
The fines and extra drills, confinement to barracks, that sort of thing. I think fines were a thing that they... objected to more than anything. They were very conscious of the rupee, and they liked to have them, and therefore a fine for real negligence or loss of equipment or something of that sort might be imposed. My own part, I don't remember administering any form of punishment while I was with the Camel Corps. I certainly had disciplinary cases, but usually I persuaded the accused to reform or to see the folly of his ways, and I don't remember needing to punish. I may have fined a few for some negligence over loss of equipment or something of that sort. Or, of course, if they struck an NCO, then that would be quite serious, and they could then go to the commanding officer and ultimately to a court-martial.
Did any instances of that occur where they struck NCOs that you can remember?
I don't think a case came my way. There were one or two court-martial cases, usually theft of money or something of that sort that led to a court-martial. I do remember a man being court-martialed in Barao, and the court said to him, they found him not guilty, and they said, "You're discharged from the court." Well, the interpreter, they were very good as a rule, he put it over to the man, "You're discharged from the corps." And he promptly left the Camel Corps and went marching across the desert home, where we had to send for him to get him back. He'd been discharged from the court. It was an honourable discharge.